From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Journalist Ron Fournier was a big success in the world of Washington politics and coverage. At home, as a father, he was okay, but often gone, distracted, casually pushing expectations that did not always fit his kids, especially his son. Then he changed. American fatherhood is changing. This hour, On Point, rethinking fatherhood and finding your children where they are with a father who's done both. Joining me now from Washington is Ron Fournier, author of the new book, Love That Boy, What Two Presidents, Eight Road Trips, and My Son Taught Me About a Parent's Expectations. Ron is senior political columnist for the National Journal, has covered presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama as an award-winning reporter for years. Ron Fournier, welcome back to On Point. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So Frank Bruni read your book and decided you're the better father. You're the new model. Are you carving out the new way of fatherhood?
No, my kids and my wife would both say that is too highfalutin for me. I'm a dad who loves his kids very much and did as good as I can, but realized late in that job that I hadn't been very well trained for it, because none of us are, and I needed to get better. And my wife had a very good plan, and I just did what I could to execute it.
There was a moment about half a dozen years ago when suddenly all was revealed, what needed to happen. There was kind of a demand there from your wife. Take us back to what was going on with you, the family, Tyler, your son.
Well, I just was relatively new as a bureau chief for the Associated Press, which was is the largest bureau in the largest news organization in the country.
And Washington.
Loving my job. Mm-hmm. Or in the world, actually, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Lori realized through watching a TV show called Parenthood that maybe these things we'd seen in Tyre, maybe it suggested that he was autistic. So she makes an appointment. We go to the doctor, and the doctor does some tests and diagnoses him with Asperger's syndrome, which is a high in the spectrum
of autism.
For autism, mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. It basically means his social skills are beneath where they need to be. They don't come naturally to him. And on the way out of that doctor's office, Lori said, "You got to step up, man." And she got tears in her eyes. And she says, "You got to get out in the world with him, spend more time with him, bond with him, and get him outside himself so that he can learn these skills that we're now realizing aren't just uncomfortable to him, things like shaking hands and looking people in the eyes and modulating his voice, mm-hmm. but they're actually unnatural to him." And she came up with this idea to take these road trips because Tyler's – one of his fixations then was – and still is – history. And my job was presidency. So she combined the two, literally in the parking lot, walking out of the doctor's office and said, "You know, you're going to spend the next year or so going to presidential libraries and presidential sites and getting to know him and getting him to know the world."
He was 12. It was just about I guess it's never too late, but it was a pretty good age at which to do that. He was big enough to understand a lot. You took off. We'll look at those road trips, what you learned, and what you learned sitting down with presidents. But how did you assess yourself at that moment when you finally sort of got the word on what was going on and maybe had a clearer understanding of it? How did you look back on the fathering that you had been doing, not just with Tyler, but with your daughters, Holly and Gabrielle as well?
Yeah, the two older daughters. Well, like any father, any mother, it's not like it. That was the first time that I was self-reflective and realizing mm-hmm. I wasn't doing a good enough job. You carry a lot of guilt and a lot of regret. That's part of the baggage we carry as parents. This did give me, you know, on one hand, very scary to hear that my son had autism. But on the other hand, it was kind of a relief. Okay, now we got something to attack. And look at this wonderful woman that I'm lucky to be married to has a plan. So it was like an assignment. You know, my editors have been giving me assignments for years. Mm-hmm. Now I got one for my wife. So in a way, it was kind of liberating and it sure was a heck of a lot of fun once we got out there.
What is it that you were missing or doing that you wished you weren't once you understood what was up with Tyler?
Well, one thing was it took too long for us to realize what was up with him. It's hard to diagnose autism as a parent. That's one thing I hope parents, when they read this, it might make it easier for them to see these signs in their children. There's not a blood test you can take. It's a subjective judgment that doctors make. But also we were afraid, I shouldn't say we, I was afraid mm-hmm. to admit that he might be different. That's one of the expectations we have for our kids. One of many is that we want them to be normal, whatever the heck that is. You know, news break here, folks. All of our kids are abnormal, you know.
Yes.
But I didn't want to admit he was different. I didn't want to be looking for a label. Although, you know, the irony is here. Once we had the label, it was liberating.
You write that a parent's love is unconditional, but a parent's expectations, that's something else again. What do you mean?
We all love our kids. You'd have to be a monster not to love your kids unconditionally. And I don't want any parent out there to think that I'm passing judgment on them or even myself. I love my kids to death. But we all have caveats. We all have certain things that we want our kids to be or do because we think it's best for them. We want them to all be normal, whatever that is. We want them to be geniuses. We want them to be popular. We want them to be successful. We want them to be happy. The problem is our definition for many of those expectations, as I go into Love That Boy and the research I did with child development experts and even interviewing other parents, our definition of those things are often warped. And our efforts to shape them into our idea of the perfect kid often misshapes them and sometimes hurts and kills them.
Hurts and kills because they want to respond to a parent's expectations.
Right. And a parent's expectations, because of the days we live in, aren't the only pressures, aren't the only expectations a young man or woman has on them today. Look at pop culture. Look at the kind of things that technology exposes kids to. So it's already hard enough to grow up in this environment, in this culture. When you have a parent saying you've got to go to an Ivy League school, you've got to throw a fastball 90 miles an hour, you've got to be a belly dancer like I was. You've got to have a whole bunch of friends or you're a failure. That just adds to what is already an awfully toxic mix for children today.
You had people trying to give you the signal. Among them, and quite movingly, the title of the book comes from this, but among them, President George W. Bush. There's a little bit there in the book where you're visiting the Oval Office. He's there. Tyler is with you and sort of making a rumpus, fixated on the president's dog, Barney. Could you read a little bit from us from Love That Boy?
I'd love to. I got to tell you, this is the first time I've done this since I wrote it quite a while ago now.
Welcome back. Right.
Yeah. I hope I like it.
Yeah.
Barney, yelled Tyler. Barney. I cringed. Tyler was a loving, charming, and brilliant boy. He had a photographic memory. But he was somehow different. His voice was jarringly deep and loud for a kid his age. He fixated on topics like presidential history and animals. He was, in a word, quirky. But the president was enchanted. He laughed, listened, and asked Tyler several questions about dogs before gathering us together for photos. Look at your shoes, Bush told Tyler while putting a hand on my boy's shoulder and steering him towards the photographer. They're ugly, just like your dad's. Tyler's head rocked back in laughter and his right foot kicked out. His whole body shook. A few minutes later, we were walking out of the Oval Office when Bush grabbed me by the elbow. Love that boy, he said, holding my eyes. I thought I understood what he meant. I didn't. It took me years to understand.
Love that boy, said the president. And from that, George W. Bush comes the title of Ron Fournier's new book. He saw something that you weren't quite seeing, maybe. We think of George W. Bush as, you know, sort of blowing past the details, but he didn't blow past your son.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'd always kind of thought that the two presidents I covered first, Bill Clinton and George Bush, that Bill Clinton was, you know, obviously has great empathy and can feel a nation's pain. Bush has always struck me as somebody who's not as good at that, but really reads a room well. And he did here. I know he could see how anxious I was and how I was afraid that my son was wasting his time, embarrassing himself, and worst of all, embarrassing me. And so I don't know really what the president meant by that. It could have just been, you know, love your kid unconditionally. Mm-hmm. I know I took away from it, hey, he's telling me to love my kid despite the fact that he's quirky and he caused a rumpus in the Oval Room, despite the fact that he's a little odd. It was over the course of the next 10 years, and especially the last year when Lori sent us on this journey and I started doing this research, that I realized, no, I can't just love Tyler despite his idiosyncrasies. I love him because of his idiosyncrasies. What makes him different, what makes all of our kids different, is what makes them special.
I've got listeners for you already, Ron, and I want to go to them. Mike in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. You're on the air with journalist, father, Ron Fournier. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir. What do you know?
Well, I had a similar experience with having to make a complete change in my lifestyle to help raise the kids. My wife was changing careers and was heading back to school and really needed to do this to get her master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up making a career change from being a construction worker that was on the road quite a bit to being a stay-at-home dad that was fully involved in raising his children and being kind of a Mr. Mom while she chased her dream. And at first, the first 30 days were rather sobering and enlightening as to how much work was involved in the day-to-day.
Yes.
and taking care of the kids.
Yep.
But since then, it's probably been the most rewarding thing I've ever done in my life.
How's it changed you, Mike? How has it changed you?
It changed me in the fact that, I became a whole lot more sensitive to what he was discussing about the pressures on the kids as they were growing up, and as they were dealing with their demons every day.
Yep.
And to try and make them better people, I kept stressing to them, you got to follow what makes you happy, and do that first and foremost, and everything else will fall into place. And as they grew up and got older, and they became three great people. They're all well educated, and all three of them are engineers.
Yep.
And do really well. But I would stress every day to them, listen, don't do what I want you to do. You got to first chase what you want to do, and what makes you happy and complete. And I said, and it really helps if you can feed yourself doing that. get into a career that you can, you know, pay your bills and support yourself.
Mike, that's pretty great. We're up against a break, but it sounds to me like you beat Ron Fournier to the inside.
Amen. Amen.
But Ron brings it to us very beautifully as well in his new book, Love That Boy, What Two Presidents, Eight Road Trips, and My Son Taught Me About a Parent's Expectations. Ron, we'll come back to that and much more. Please stand by there in Washington. It's so great to have you. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about fatherhood and seeing and loving children for who they are. Rethinking fatherhood, maybe, seeing a new kind of father with big-time political reporter, columnist Ron Fournier. He's had his own big rethink of fathering, fathers and children. He tells the story in his new book. It is Love That Boy, What Two Presidents, Eight Road Trips, and My Son Taught Me About a Parent's Expectations. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ironically, or maybe not, the TV show Parenthood, the NBC drama, played a role in Ron and his wife, Lori, figuring out that their son, Tyler, has Asperger's. Here's a little scene from Parenthood. Adam, played by Peter Crosby, whose son Max has Asperger's, gives advice to his younger brother Crosby, Dax Shepard. Crosby's worried about his own 10-year-old son, who decided to take up ballet here as a winter sport instead of basketball.
I'm talking about being able to share something with him that I could connect with him on.
I get it, okay? Crosby, your kids aren't always going to be interested in the things that you're interested in. They're not always going to be interested in the things you want them to be, okay? I wish that Max had been more interested in baseball than bugs. That's not how it worked out. Okay, so I got interested in bugs.
Baseball and bugs, and you go where your child is. As you drove those miles, as you headed out for those presidential homes and libraries and all the restaurant, and to the White House to meet with presidents, I mean, how long did it take you to come around to the insight that you've got here that, you know, love the child for who he or she is?
You know, when you read the book, I think you'll see I always knew it. You know, intellectually, we know that that's our job, is to find that balance between guiding and pushing, and accepting. You know, nobody wants to create a mini-me. So it wasn't that I learned that this is what I had to do. I think by listening to him, listening to my wife, talking to a lot of child development experts, talking to three dozen other parents, I learned how to do it, and to be a lot more self-conscious.
Do you think that this is you went through a very particular process and you write about it beautifully, but do you think American fathers in general are on a trend toward this more open, more sensitive? That's a word our caller Mike used just now. You know, Frank Bruni writes sometimes gentler, tenderer, unafraid to broach discussions, display emotions that men once shrank from. Do you see it as a cultural tide?
I have to admit, I didn't. This is the genius of Frank Bruni. That's not something I really thought about or really even realized I was writing about until Frank wrote that wonderful column last Sunday, where he really pulled on that thread, and he's exactly right. Look, motherhood is really changing. It's a lot different to be a mom today than it was a generation ago. Thankfully, women like my wife and my daughters, they have a lot more opportunities than they did before. The expectations for them aren't as narrow. So that's going to have to change the way dads do their jobs. And maybe even more importantly, being a child today is so much different than it was when we were kids. The pop culture influences, the fact that we have technologies that make thing, you know, in a way makes life so much easier for children and parents, but also makes it a lot more dangerous. You know, I have every pervert in the world in my living room through the iPad, and that's an awfully scary thing and an awfully dangerous thing for children. So, yeah, as the institution, the world's oldest institution, humanity's oldest institution, the family, as it changes, one of the pillars of that institution has to adapt as well. And fathers really have it. I know one thing that's really been rewarding, again, surprisingly, is I've been asked to speak to autism centers and schools around the country. And invariably what they're having me do is just talk to dads, because they have a hard time getting dads to come to the school, even after work. The moms are really involved in their kids' lives, mm-hmm. especially with these special needs kids. But the dads, for a lot of reasons, aren't. And you know, you get two dads together, you get me and my buddies together, we're going to talk about sports. We're not going to talk about our kids very much. And we're certainly not going to talk about our failures as fathers or our feelings as fathers and husbands. And if I can get fathers doing a little bit more of that, you know, that wouldn't be a bad thing, because the first step, we know what we need to do, but we need to be talking to each other to figure out how to do it better.
Amy in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Amy, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Ron Fournier.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
This conversation takes me back to the summer that I learned that not only that my son was a high-functioning autistic, that my daughter had attention deficit. My son is three years old at the time, mm-hmm. and my daughter was six. And my husband and I had to make a whole bunch of changes. We had, you know, the school year all planned out. And we found we got the diagnosis at the end of August, and that just uprooted everything. I think that one of the things that was really surprising to me, especially with my son, is that, you know, he likes structure and he falls into disciplines and tasks really easy. And the thing that I found out that I really need to do, instead of instilling him with discipline and, you know, kind of like correcting his behavior, the thing that I found out that I needed to do most was provide him a safe and secure social environment where he could just be himself, that he had autonomy. And, you know, and a lot of the problems went away when we stopped trying to dictate to him much and just let him be himself.
Amy, was there a father involved in that as well? Were you equally on board with that that approach?
Yeah, you know, it is. It's funny because, you know, my son takes after me. I look back on my childhood now and say, oh, I guess I was the autistic young woman. But my husband, he's more the attention deficit. And I feel like we're dealing with the same thing. We're dealing with this sensory organization and overload. And we make two choices. One choice is to focus on things. And I think that's what autistic kids do. And I think what the folks who have attention deficit, they're more likely to focus on people. So
Interesting.
And they're like two different choices. And my husband's more of the AD person. He focuses on people. So
right. You got both angles covered.
Yeah.
Not too much structure. Leave it open. Ron, what do you say? And what about Tyler when you would come into the presidential libraries? How did he respond? I was into that history, but was it the things, the books, the people, the... And what about Amy's observation? Just give him space.
One of the great lessons that I got out of this book was actually by watching my niece. It was funny. I kind of became an observer. I actually interviewed my wife, interviewed my kids. Mm-hmm. I became a reporter about my own family. And one of the things was watching my niece, who lives in Arkansas, and she would come visit us, and she would go downstairs in the basement where Tyler likes to hang out. And instead of doing like some family members would do, which was not ever go downstairs, or what I would always do, which would go downstairs and start peppering him with questions and trying to get him to talk, and mm-hmm. you got to have more friends. And she would just go downstairs and just sit next to him. And she would read. And she'd be down there for a couple hours, wouldn't mm-hmm. say a word to him. Mm-hmm. And we realized that the power of presence. He was no longer alone. He liked having her down there. But he liked the fact that she never – put any pressure on to even have a conversation, which to Tyler is a hard thing.
Mm-hmm.
So every kid is different, whether they're special needs or not. And yeah, if you can find that the way that they can be the best at whatever they're the best at and like the most, you're going to be successful as a parent. On the trips, Tyler was much more fixated on the things that interested him, which were mainly objects. or a topic that he was really wound up around. And you'll see in the book where he would just constantly – he was raising me. He was teaching me how to be a better father and a better friend and a better acquaintance to him. He would tell me when to back off and let me in. There was moments where he revealed a part of himself that I'd never seen before because I was present with him and I was starting to pick up his clues a little bit.
Good for you. The new book is Love That Boy. Ron Fornia, stand by in Washington, if you would. I want to bring for a few minutes in here with us Michael Kimmel. He joins us from Brooklyn in New York. Distinguished professor of sociology, gender studies at Stony Brook University. Founder, editor of the academic journal Men and Masculinities. Author of Manhood in America, a Cultural History. Michael Kimmel, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
So Ron Fournier's book has brought out this observation from Frank Bruni, anyway, that American fatherhood is changing, that there's room for something more tender, more gentle, more engaged, more openly sensitive. Do you see American fatherhood changing, Michael?
No, there's no question. Fatherhood is changing both as an ideal. That is to say, if you look at what American men who are Gen Y or millennials say, they all want to be awesome dads. They all want to be really involved in their kids' lives, and they all are planning for this. They're all thinking about this. So as an ideal, it's definitely the case, but also as a set of practices, things men are doing. Men are, in fact, doing far more childcare than ever before. This is not, you know, we are not producing another generation of Don Drapers here who are basically absentee landlords at home. They are really very involved in their kids' lives. Now, this is, so men are doing more. Now, I have to say, it's not that women are doing significantly less. Women, in fact, are doing more childcare and housework than they ever did, too. But men are, in fact, doing more on the childcare front. Not so much more housework, unfortunately. And so what's happening in a lot of cases is that dad is becoming the fun parent, by which I mean dad takes the kids to the park on Saturday morning to play soccer while mom does the breakfast dishes, makes the bed, does the laundry, and makes lunch.
Ooh,
the kids come home and they say, oh, we had such a great time with dad. He's such an involved parent. And her activities, which are also, by the way, childcare, are completely invisible.
What about the time and the attitude of fathers while they're doing that? Okay, I get it. There's still an issue here on who's doing what, the workload and the sharing. Is it a different kind of engagement? Do you think it will change a generation of children growing up with more engaged, sensitive, attention-paying fathers?
Absolutely. I think what we are doing now and what work by like Ron tends to do, I think, is it degenders the behaviors. Once upon a time, we thought that being competent and assertive in the workplace was a masculine trait and that women, well, they could do it or not, but then they'd risk not being seen as women. And we thought loving and nurturing children was something that women did. And I grew up in a family not unlike, very much like the one that Ron is now describing in his own life.
Mm-hmm.
Both my parents worked. So for me, working outside the home was something grown-ups did, not something that men did. And then also my father was very involved in my growing up. So I grew up thinking that loving and nurturing were things that grown-ups did, not simply that moms did. And what that did is it degendered not the people. They were still men and women. But it degendered what they did. And men are finding that it doesn't hurt our masculinity in the slightest. In fact, it's now seen as an expression of our masculinity to be caring of others, to take care of our families. And I think you saw this in the last Super Bowl, not the one this past January, the one before, when suddenly there were all these new ads about involved fathers for the first time in Super Bowl history.
Even in the middle of the Super Bowl, Michael Kimmel, please stand by. Ron Fournier, the new book is Love That Boy. And yes, men can get props for this these days. What might have at one time been seen as, embarrassing. Here's a little bit from Mike Adamick, stay-at-home dad, primary caregiver for a preteen daughter. This was an interview on the Today Show last year. He said there's a double standard now for male and female caregivers. Listen.
I've definitely gotten some people that have literally applauded me on the sidewalk. Way to go, Dad. And I'm just walking down the street with my daughter. You know, that would never happen to a woman, and it's a little bogus. I'm not really doing much. I'm just doing my job of being a dad.
I don't know how often moms get applauded on the street for walking down the street with their kids. I mean, Ron Fournier, you say that, I mean, your father looked at your relationship with Tyler. You were at the Ford Library in your pilgrimage here to on road trips, and he said to you that he had never really pushed you, and he said to you, your dad said to you, you're not me, and he, your son, is not you.
Yeah, that was a kick in the stomach, because my relationship with my dad was wonderful, and it was all built around sports. We were the Field of Dreams cliche. Mm-hmm. And I got into sports because I loved them, and that, you know, the last conversation I had with my dad before he passed away was about the Detroit Tigers and Gordie Howe with the Wings. But what he was telling me there was, look, there's a reason why Tyler doesn't like sports, and there's another way to do this. And when we came back from that trip, I talked to Lori, and we decided to give Tyler a deal. You don't have to play sports anymore if you do two things that we thought were important for you to play sports. One is to exercise a couple times a week, and mm-hmm. two is to do something extracurricular at school. It could be chess club or anything. So I sat Tyler down in the sunroom. He was 13 at the time, and I offered him his deal, and he said, I'll take that deal. And he gives me a big handshake, and then he's quiet, and he's not saying anything. I said, what's something wrong, buddy? He says, yeah, I was afraid if I didn't play sports that you wouldn't love me anymore.
Wow.
Now, you know, I never pushed him into sports because I wanted him to, you know, fulfill my fantasies or be the quarterback I couldn't be. But I did push him into sports because it was the only way I had bothered to think that I could connect with him. And so I made my son think that I wasn't going to love him unless he played sports. And you know, that's a terrible burden to have put on him, even though I think we now have it right after he turned 12 or 13.
Michael, you've thought a lot about these things. I mean, Ron Fournier's conclusion is pull back off this expectations game. Let your child be the person that they are meant to be. What about expectations? How do you look at them, Michael? In the past, that was part of what was seen as a parent's job. Have expectations. Set expectations.
Well, I think there's a kind of mutual or reciprocal relationship between parents and their children. I completely agree with Ron. I think that you have to sort of lead from behind with a child. My job as a father to my son has been to, I don't get to choose what he falls in love with. My job is to recognize, oh, look, he seems to be falling in love with this. Now I will encourage that. Because what you know, what every grown-up knows, is that when your kid commits to something emotionally, falls in love with mm-hmm. it, you know, they're going to, like, want to do it. They're going to do it more. And so my job was just basically to figure out what is he falling in love with and then let him lead me into it. And I will say, I will confess, I'm a baby boomer, and in my era, soccer was a non-entity in the sporting world. I knew nothing about it. I played baseball in high school. You know, I knew football, I knew basketball, I knew baseball. My son is a soccer player. I had to learn about soccer. We've gone all over Europe watching soccer games. It's been one of the most important parts of our relationship. But I let him take me there because, you know, I did it because I was one day walking down the street with him bemoaning the fact that, you know, he didn't study the baseball statistics every morning the way I did every morning of my childhood and still do.
Let it go.
Right? I was thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, he doesn't, you know, he'll never know what Derek Jeter's batting average is. And, you know, and suddenly he turns to me and he says, Dad, you know, the transfer window is closing this week, and I don't know if you know, Barcelona is going to be able to get Suarez. And I thought, wait a minute, do you know all the players on all of those teams? And he says, of course. I said, tell me the starting 11 of Bayern Munich right now. He did, without hesitation. I said, how do you know this? He said, well, I get up every morning, and I read, and I go online. And I thought, oh, my God, he's fallen in love with something. You know, I better learn about soccer.
Meet your child where that child is. It's a great story. Michael Kimmel, author of Manhood in America. Michael, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Ron, you had to stretch even a little further than that, I guess.
That's a great story.
It's a wonderful story.
He likes bugs. I better learn to know bugs.
Right. Ron Fournier's new book is Love That Boy, What Two Presidents, Eight Road Trips, and My Son Taught Me About a Parent's Expectations. Ron, stand by in Washington. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about fatherhood and seeing, loving children for who they are Rethinking Fatherhood with a big-time political reporter, columnist Ron Fournier. Spent many years covering presidencies and everything going on in Washington. He's had his own big rethink of fathering and fathers and children. Tells that story in his new book, Love That Boy. He joins us this hour from Washington, D.C. Lots of response online, Ron. Ray says on our website, kids will be their own people, whether you want them to be or not. Here, Upti says, my hardest change in me, loving them enough to father them without projecting my fears onto them. Fears are powerful and subtle. There was a moment in your road trips when you were coming back from, I guess, the Jefferson estate there, and had a great conversation with Tyler. Was he still 12 or 13 at that time?
13.
13, about what you loved, about what he loved, about his happiness. I wonder if you'd read a little bit from Love That Boy.
Yeah, this is a chapter on happiness, and so we open it with our road trip to Monticello, where the gentleman pursued happiness. Tyler says, "You love writing. I can barely pick up a pencil. You love playing sports, and I was never a sports guy." "Yes," I say. "What do you make of that?" "Kids aren't always going to be like you," he says. "My kids could grow up and be freaking jocks, for all I know." I'm stunned. I can't believe he's opening up, even this little. It's rare to hear him talk about his future, let alone fatherhood. I balance my notebook on the steering wheel and start scribbling at 60 miles an hour. "I'd approve of them playing sports," Tyler tells me and laughs. "Heck, I'd even go to their games." I protest. "He won't go to sporting events with me." "Yes, but you're a dad and not my kids. I'll do what my kids need me to do." I ask whether he felt pushed into sports. "I guess, but you never said you've got to play baseball, Tyler. You said, hey, buddy, you want to play ball? I knew you wanted me to play. I knew it was important to you that we played together. So I did it for you." I circled back to the happiness paradox, how I wanted him to be happy, but my actions might have had the opposite effect. "Were you happy as a little kid?" I wince, afraid of the answer. "I'd say so." "Now?" "I'm happy for now, I'd say so. My kind of happy."
Tyler telling his dad, Ron Fournier, with us right here, he's my kind of happy. Have you found real peace with that, that he will have, must have, his kind of happy, Ron?
You never find peace as a parent, do you?
Well, you dream,
yes,
you wish.
I found an intellectual peace with it. I know he's right. I know he's searching for his happiness, but there's not a day that goes by that I don't worry. Is he really going to be happy? What really is happiness? You know, he's never going to have the circle of friends that I have, but I know that he doesn't necessarily have to have that. But what is it that he does have to have? I really don't know. It's something that we're going to be working on now together, you know, the rest of my life. So peace? No, you never think you got it nailed as a parent. I don't think I'll ever be at peace with how I'm doing this job.
Just keep trying. Just keep loving.
Keep trying. Love that boy.
Love that boy. Kristen in Decatur, Illinois. Kristen, glad you called. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I've had a similar experience as far as my son being diagnosed with Asperger's, and we didn't find out until later on. He was about 7 or 8, I think.
Okay.
And, you know, our life kind of revolved around working and the normal type schedule that a household keeps. And he wasn't, you know, they call them very high functioning, but he wasn't. There was a lot of melt.
Yeah. Do we still have you, Kristen?
Pardon me?
We, there are a lot of meltdowns. Is that what you said there?
Yes. A lot. All morning, all evening. It was a very, for Isaiah, my son, it was not a working schedule, and it took me quite a while to realize that in order for things to be right for him, I had to change my perception of what was okay for our family. So a couple of years ago, I scaled back all the working. I take him and pick him up from school. We spend a lot more time together. And over a period of time, he did end up becoming much happier and quite a bit more functional. He's doing really well now, and it took us a long time to get there. But just like Ron said, we all have this idea of normal, and we want our kids to be normal.
Yeah.
But there really is no normal. It's mm-hmm. so hard to realize mm-hmm. sometimes. And I think we have to look for, especially in these kids, what is extremely special about them and how smart they are and how much they know about the things that they love yeah. and that that's okay. And that if we allow them, they can actually teach us so much.
Yeah.
So much.
Christian, you've clearly done the work in your family, including stepping back some from work. I want to get a chance to offer that to Ron, but I really appreciate your call, and I wish you very good luck there with your family and your son. Ron, this idea of letting go of this idea of normal and also changing work. You did some of that.
Yeah, boy, that really hit home. You know, I know Lori and I are very lucky that we have the means to be able to adjust our lives and take more time with our children. What really pains me is knowing there's a lot of families out there who can't even get their kids diagnosed, don't have the ability to do that. And if they do get them diagnosed, can't get the services for them. And if they do get the services for them in school, in public school, once you get out of school and your child turns 18, which mine's about to, the services dry up. We spend millions of dollars on research around autism, which is laudable, and we need to do that. Mm-hmm. But only a fraction of it, I'm talking like 1% or 2%, goes towards services for adult ASPE, services for adults who are on the spectrum. And that's really got to change, because I guarantee you that wonderful mother who we're just talking to has a hard time sleeping every single night, wondering what's going to happen to her child when she's not here anymore. And we as a people have got to make sure we're taking care of these men and women as they age through our society.
Carrie in Milwaukee, you're on with Ron Fournier. Thank you very much for calling and waiting so long, Carrie. Thank you.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you. My son is brilliant, high functioning, had difficulty getting him diagnosed. Where I live, there is an 8-year-old cutoff for many of the services. And because of the difficulties, we missed that. But the thing is, first, I worked so hard to get him diagnosed because of the need for that label. I was afraid to get him diagnosed because of labeling him.
Yeah.
I find, though, that I myself am now using that label a year yeah. later as a way almost of apologizing at playgrounds or where have you, almost like with his quirkiness, as your guest so eloquently put it, almost like saying, it's not my bad mothering. She's autistic.
Yeah.
Well, how am I going to
use it to step away, distance yourself a little. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. How am I going to raise my son to be self-accepting if I keep apologizing for him? That's not going to happen, and I need to get back to, as she put it, loving the whole son.
Yeah.
That is what is him. A question I have for your guest is if he is going to come out by any chance with another book, or if a point is covered in his book about families and the siblings of autistic children, because he has a sister. Mm-hmm. I have a daughter that's constantly in shadow. Their father has tried very much to wrap his head around this, but I am now a single mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's great that all this attention is to the autistic needs. But even in these conversations, are focused so much on the autistic needs. And it's true, I need to stop apologizing for my son if my son's going to accept himself. But where do the other siblings come in too?
Carrie, let us pick up both of those really strong points. The first one, so subtle but interesting, about using the label to kind of distance yourself in some way. And then the siblings, you've got two daughters in addition to Tyler. Ron, speak to both of those, Ron.
Well, first on the label, that's a powerful point, and I've caught myself using the label the same way to apologize for my son. And you're right, it's not good for him and it's not good for you. Let me tell you how we try to use it now. We use it for his benefit and for ours. First of all, it was a great way to explain to my family, who loved Tyler unconditionally and wanted to help us. They knew there was something going on, but they didn't know quite what. They didn't want to, family and friends, by the way, you know, our circle of family. They didn't know. They were afraid to ask. They didn't know how to help. And having this label and being able to say to him, here's who he is and here's why he is and here's the best way to deal with him, was a great liberator inside the family. They always loved Tyler, but now they're actually really able to help him with us. The other thing is to use it as a weapon, to get the services your kid deserves. The best piece of advice we got that first day when Dr. Mitty Quinn in McLean diagnosed Tyler, McLean, Virginia, she said, now, when you go to your next IEP meeting, that's the educational special needs meetings that we're already having for Tyler from second grade because of attention deficit disorder.
Yeah.
She said, walk in. Here's a list of services that your son needs. They're going to give you all kinds of reasons why they can't give you those services. Even though it's a great public school that my child goes to, you know, they don't want to spend that money. So she says, here's what you say. As soon as they put up roadblocks, you say, so you're telling me you can't educate my son? And what that turns out to be, at least in our public school, is a signal to the public school that you know that you have the legal right to take your money, federal and state money that's behind your child, and walking it out the door to a private school. And as soon as we said that, the whole posture in the meeting changed, and all of a sudden some wonderful services have really changed, Tyler, really kicked in. So use that label for better understanding and to get what your child needs. And the second thing, you know, I've been surprised. There's been so much about this book that I didn't really realize I was writing about, like Frank Bruni and the Changing Fatherhood. Mm-hmm. Another one is this thing with the siblings. There's so many people who've come up to me and talked to me and said, you know, I really love reading about Holly, who had mental health issues when she's the oldest daughter. Mm-hmm. The middle daughter, she's hardly even mentioned in the book, but she seems to be so successful and so charismatic and so beautiful. How has this affected them? And then real quickly, the bottom line is, one, there obviously is some neglect. And there's only so much time he has of a parent. So I think there's naturally going to be some resentment among the other siblings. But, boy, I tell you, these two girls, because they were a part of raising Tyler and because they grew up in a very empathetic, tolerant environment, realizing that they had to bend to somebody else's needs, my two oldest daughters are just incredible young women. Who I think were partly shaped by the fact that their parents couldn't spend as much time with them, and they had to step up from an early age and help mother Tyler.
We're talking about fatherhood and seeing loving children for who they are. Ron Fournier's book is Love That Boy. Aaron, in Dayton, Ohio, thanks for calling, Aaron. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm calling just in perspective of my brother actually has Asperger's, and he is an adult. And he lives with me. And so I appreciate the perspective from a parent perspective, but as a brother, it has its own challenges as well. It's been very good and it's been very challenging, but it's been neat to see him begin to embrace his adulthood and to kind of come to terms with the way he sees life.
Do you feel that you were neglected as your parents worked to bring up your brother, Aaron?
Not at all. In fact, we have a large family, and we kind of all played a part. There are multiple siblings, so we've all kind of looked at this case, or not the case, we looked at the person who is my brother and trying to figure out how to love him and then how to interact with him and how to appreciate the things that he appreciates in life.
Is he going to be able to live on his own, do it on his own?
Yeah, he is. And this is just a temporary thing, but we're glad to be able to provide him some shelter right now and just a safe place as he for the next little bit until he's able to get out on his own.
You're a good man, a good brother, and I appreciate your call from Dayton, Aaron. Thank you very much. One more, Robert in Omaha, Nebraska. Robert, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate this.
Yeah.
I want a little different perspective. I'm an adult with Asperger's.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 58 years old now. I was misdiagnosed in my mid-30s as being bipolar syndrome.
Okay.
So I went through the whole gamut of the psychiatric medications, electric shock therapy, and so on. None of it worked.
Yep.
I finally came across a very good social worker therapist. And he kept saying, I don't think you're bipolar. And so he did a lot of research and down at the University of Texas. And then later on, I had a whole battery of cognitive testing and had other psychologist confirmed the diagnosis of me being Asperger's.
So you know you're in that category. Forgive me, Robert, but help us because the time is short. What are you thinking as you listen to the story of Ron Fournier and his son Tyler then?
I also heard a show on Saturday with Mr. Fournier, and I believe he's directing more too much of this to himself. You need to listen to the person, you know, in my case, Asperger's, and find out what they're thinking about. What I'm still going through is I'm really not sure how other non-Aspergian people see things, and it's a puzzle to me. How I perceive something is probably quite different than others. So it's what I've been hearing this morning, it's kind of superficial. You need to dig deeper and find out exactly what your child is thinking, or your adult child, possibly.
Robert, let us work with that. I've only got a minute here left, but I really appreciate your call. Ron, this is interesting. That is, as much as you may have changed to re-navigate fatherhood here, our caller Robert, who's lived it for a long time, says that maybe you're just getting started.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I'm just getting started as a parent and just getting started as a reporter trying to figure out how to walk in the shoes of these wonderful people who just don't happen to be wired the way I am. For the book, I did talk to parents, not just parents of folks with Asperger's and other conditions, but with Aspies. And there's a gentleman here who's about my age, 52 years old, named Mitch Dworkin, who is one of the other threads that's woven through the book, and his relationship with his father and his relationship with neurotypical people and how he has a hard time seeing how we see him. I really feel for the gentleman who was just on the phone.
It's a two-way street. Interesting moment here. Bill Clinton sits down and talks with Tyler and talks and talks and talks. You end up wondering, is Bill Clinton an Aspie?
He's not, but interesting.
It was. The whole thing is a great insight into one family story. Great reporter telling it. And Ron, we wish you such good luck with Tyler and the whole family there. It's great to get to know you all through the book. And we're grateful to you for sharing with such openness and candor here. It really brings a lot of value. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Tommy. Take care.
Ron Fournier's new book is Love That Boy, What Two Presidents, Eight Road Trips, and My Son Taught Me About a Parent's Expectations. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.